With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, how a California rancher successfully conserves 500 acres on a working cattle ranch. We'll have more on that, but we start today with the World Food Prize. Two champions of seed conservation and crop diversity are honored as this year's World Food Prize laureates. Here's Rod Bain.
Announced Thursday, the 2024 World Food Prize laureates.
They are Dr. Jeffrey Houghton of the United Kingdom and Canada and Dr. Kerry Fowler of the United States.
World Food Prize Foundation President Terry Branstad with the news. Both laureates are noted for their efforts in establishing a global seed bank to assure seed conservation and crop biodiversity. The announcement coincided with an anniversary.
For 20 years, the State Department has hosted the World Food Prize Laureate Ceremony to honor the exceptional scientists and advocates who have transformed global food systems.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Both recently announced laureates will officially receive their honor during the annual Norman Borlaug Dialogue at World Food Prize Laureate Ceremony in late October in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The world's women farmers will get a lot more attention in 2026. Gary Crawford has the story.
The international community has chosen to call attention to the challenges women in agriculture continue to face.
And there are plenty of challenges out there, according to the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. We'll get to those challenges in a second. The ambassador went before reporters at the U.S. General Assembly meeting the other day and announced that the assembly had just passed a resolution spearheaded by the U.S. with support from 100 other nations, a resolution declaring the year 2026 as the International Year of the Woman Farmer. And she said most people don't even realize how much women farmers contribute to the world's food supply. It turns out about half the world's food, and in some countries, 80% of their food is produced by women farmers.
And they farm with less financial backing, less technology, less education, less cultural and governmental support than their male counterparts. This lack of training and resources and support doesn't just hamper women farmers' productivity, it holds back progress in every sustainable development goal, from combating climate change to ensuring economic stability to fighting food insecurity, which disproportionately affect women and girls.
And so, U.S. Deputy Agriculture Secretary Xochitl Torres-Small, who was also there, said this U.N. resolution will explore
different ways to support women farmers, whether that's land ownership, whether that's tech transfer and how we can use agrotech to support women farmers, or whether that's support through technical assistance.
So as Linda Thomas-Greenfield put it, with this special year dedicated to women in agriculture,
we aim to increase awareness of women's roles in farming and lack of secure land tenure that continues to hinder far too many of them.
So this upcoming very special year will have lots of programs and projects designed
to better understand the financial and technological needs of women farmers and ensure access to credit and markets, education, and technology.
She said in the fight against global food insecurity,
we have a powerful tool. And that is women farmers.
Who are doing a great job, but could do even better with just a little help. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. Chuck Zimmerman kicks off today's National Spotlight.
I'm at the Modern Ag on the National Mall here in Washington, D.C., and I have with me Rick Falconer. And first of all, Rick, tell us a little bit about who you work for and what you do.
Rick Falconer, Managing Director for Reichswan Seed Company. We're an international vegetable breeding company, still family-owned. I head over the North American division for Reichswan. We're based out of Salinas, California, and we're happy to be here in Washington, D.C.
Well, we're here in this particular spot because of ASTA, the American Seed Trade Association. Tell me a little bit about why get involved in this event and what your message is for consumers and some of our representatives here when they come by and want to know more?
Sure, yeah. We're here representing the American Seed Trade Association, a 700-member industry association. We cover all sectors of the seed industry, so from grass seed, forage seed, field crop seed. My company is specifically in the vegetable seed business, and we also have members that are flower seed companies.
What do you want to say to these folks?
Yeah, we're here to help educate. New breeding techniques are very important to the seed industry, and trying to educate people what hybrid breeding, molecular marker breeding, new technologies such as gene editing and things like that, getting the public to know a little bit about the seed business and some of our challenges and trying to produce a better product for the consumer.
Well, before we close, tell me a little about the company that you work for.
Yeah, we're celebrating our 100th year anniversary this year. So Reichswan's been around for many, many years. Reichswan is about the fourth largest vegetable breeding company in the world. North America, we're not as large as some of the other companies, but we are very focused on vegetable seed. We like to say we breed from asparagus to zucchini, so we cover a lot of species. We deal with organic seed, conventional seed, and most of the other sectors of the vegetable breeding industry.
Great. Well, it's great to talk to you here at this event. We're here in Washington, D.C., and I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
Atmospheric conditions are behind what was a significant April concerning tornado counts in the U.S., just as the peak of our nation's tornado season takes place. Rod Bain reports.
1 month down, two more to go.
April, May, and June represents the peak of the U.S. severe weather season. That is the time of year where we see our greatest numbers of not only isolated tornadoes, but also significant or severe thunderstorm winds and large hail.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says this past April illustrated that significant upturn in tornadic activity after a relatively quiet first 3 months of 2024.
Given the fact that we saw a mild winter and a general lack of extreme cold, it's not really a surprise. When you add to that the fact that we've had a very active El Nino-related storm track heading into spring, that we would have an early peak of that severe weather season.
With the last week of April particularly active tornado-wise.
If you look at April of 2024, the preliminary number coming in from the National Weather Service Storm Prediction Center indicates that we saw 373 tornadoes, and a lot of them occurring right at the end of the month, either the 25th through the 28th or the 30th. But we did see some earlier outbreaks that occurred between April 1st and 2nd, the 9th through the 11th, and the 15th through the 18th.
In terms of how this past April measures with prior years regarding tornado counts.
In the National Weather Service, they use a 30-year average. So if you look at the latest 30-year period that we have the records for, 1991 to 2020, the average number of tornadoes across the United States for the month of April is just 193. So we were almost double that 30-year average total with our account of 373 for April 2024.
Rippey says in the 21st century, there was only one April recording more tornadoes than this year.
That was the historic and deadly 2011, a year where we saw more than 550 U.S. tornado-related fatalities through the course of the year. That April featured an all-time record 817 tornadoes across the United States, hopefully a number that we'll never approach again. But again, to put that in perspective, this year's 373, if that number holds up, would rank as the number two in the 21st century.
He adds the early peak to and increased activity in this year's tornado season lent itself to climatic conditions in April.
A lot of energy coming in from the Pacific. It has been entering the country through the west or the northwest primarily. And then as those systems work their way across the Great Plains, we have a very nice temperature gradient where the storms can work with the cool air to the north, the warm, humid air coming in from the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic. And with a lot of the dynamics there, it doesn't take much of a spark to get these big storms rolling on a daily basis, with the activity peaking in the afternoon and evening and lasting into the overnight hours.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
There's help coming in the battle against herbicide-resistant weeds. Chad Smith has the details.
Now more than ever before, growers face a lot of challenges from resistant weeds and are looking for new, innovative solutions that both deliver an early season solution and help growers preserve the tools they currently use for seasons to come. Josh Putman, Technical Marketing Manager for Corn Herbicides with BASF, says herbicide resistance is a big problem in a variety of key weed species.
Many weed species that we deal with have evolved resistance to many different sites of action that we have available in the marketplace. From BASF, we created a new herbicide called Certain Herbicide to help us really battle those herbicide-resistant weed problems that growers face and ultimately provide another tool in the toolbox for those growers. The ones that come to mind, doesn't really matter where you are the two problematic pigweed species that we have, that being Palmer amaranth and water hemp. Depending on your geography, you can get into weeds like kochia, giant ragweed. Those top four right there have all developed resistance.
He says a 6-inch weed left uncontrolled can cause up to a 7% yield loss in corn production. With that in mind, he talks about herbicide selection.
You're going to want to take into account the weed species that you have that are present on your operation. There are a lot of other factors that go into selecting your herbicide, but certainly keeping in mind the products that are going to be the most beneficial, especially if you have known herbicide resistance. HPPD resistance is becoming more of a problem in a lot of our weed species, in particular Palmer and water hemp throughout the Midwest. We are seeing those herbicides as post applications are becoming less efficacious on those two weeds. Certainly a growing problem for us.
Fortunately, there is a new solution available. Putman talks about the benefits of Certain Herbicide from BASF.
When we created Certain Herbicide, we were really focused on making sure that we add another tool to that toolbox to try and preserve those HPPD products that are out there, not rely on them over and over again, which is ultimately led to resistance in the first place. Certain herbicide controls or suppresses 79 broadleaf and grass weed species, but certainly in particular, Palmer amaranth, water hemp, the morning glory type species, and the ragweeds are certainly the top five that come to mind when we talk about Certain herbicide.
Chad Smith reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
According to USDA's Economic Research Service, around 13% of U.S. farms joined federal crop insurance programs in 2022, with most participants being small family farms. The four types of small family farms included retirement, off-farm occupation, low sales, and moderate sales, and made up 54% of program participants. However, those farms received only 12% of insurance payments despite harvesting 26% of all cropland acres. Conversely, midsize and large family farms constituted 42% of participants, but harvested 67% of U.S. cropland and received 80% of insurance payments. These larger farms represent 46% of agricultural acres. Participation rates also varied widely by crop production. 62% of farms producing row crops purchased federal crop insurance, while only 9% of farms growing specialty crops did the same. The National Council of Agricultural Employers has expressed significant disappointment with the new 600-page regulation from the Department of Labor. In a scathing response to the rule, Council President and CEO Michael Marsh condemns it as being developed in bad faith, disregarding the Supreme Court's Cedar Point decision, and implying executive override of judicial rulings. While the DOL said the rule strengthens protections for workers and bolsters its ability to ensure compliance, the rule is being criticized for jeopardizing workers' protections and enabling union activism contrary to Congress's intent. Marsh argues that the rule's provisions ignore the concerns of American farmers and ranchers and should be withdrawn immediately. Additionally, Marsh sees the rule's imposition of regulations on agricultural employers as being burdensome and detrimental to the industry. California set new benchmarks as part of the efforts to convert conventional ag production into organic systems. In the state's 2022 scoping plan for achieving carbon neutrality, a goal was established to increase organic production to 20% of cultivated acres by 2045. New milestones have now been established in the recently released report, California's Nature-Based Solutions Climate Targets. The report lays out acreage targets of having 10% of annual and perennial croplands be organic systems by 2030 and 15% by 2038. Data from the California Department of Food and Agriculture indicates that the first threshold is nearly met. The most recent California Agricultural Statistic Review notes that of the 24.2 million acres of land devoted to farming and ranching in 2021, nearly 9% of that was organic acreage. Last month, industry members came together to celebrate the successful conservation of a 500-acre working cattle ranch in Calaveras County. Last year, Bruce Yates and his family partnered with the California Rangeland Trust to place a conservation easement on their ranch, forever ensuring the land will continue to function as a working landscape and continue to provide an abundance of environmental benefits to the public. The conservation easement was completed with funding from the Natural Resources Conservation Service's Agricultural Conservation Easement Program and the California Strategic Growth Council's Sustainable Agricultural Lands Conservation Program in collaboration with the Department of Conservation. The efforts to permanently protect the Yates Ranch is an example of a successful public-private partnership between a ranching family, state and federal agencies, and a qualified land trust to help protect the public interest through private land conservation. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The Bee Sure campaign from the Growing Matters Coalition helps growers protect bees and other wildlife. Today we're talking with Jeff Marvin, the Senior Director of Research and Development for PBI Gordon.
How can applicators be good stewards?
First and foremost is understanding the product, understanding the label. In that label, there are going to be guidelines for how an application should be made, when it should be made. And it's understanding that label. You know, so when I kind of look outside my window now and we're expecting some storms to come through here, and it's understanding a label from if I make an application, how quick is that product going to be rain fast? And what I mean by rain fast is you can make an application and that product is going to dry on the surface of the plant. It's going to be taken into the plant versus that product is going to wash off the plant and potentially move to an area where you don't want it to.
Brought to you by the Growing Matters Coalition. Learn more online at growingmatters.org/besure. Farmers are making fewer changes this year. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Low commodity prices, high input costs, and disappointing 2023 growing season results are influencing farmer decisions in 2024. The 2024 Farmer Speaks survey reveals that farmers are taking a more conservative approach in their decision-making. They're making fewer changes overall, driven by concerns about short-term prospects and long-term finances. Fertilizer remains the primary focus for adjustments despite more moderate prices. 52% of growers purchased fertilizer early, marking a decrease of 7% from last year's record high. Farmers say their intent to buy more ag equipment has dropped by 24% in 1 year. Farmers are also switching crop protection products far less than ever before. Survey respondents indicate they're using the same products as last year or are undecided. 36% of farmers reported purchasing seeds early, anticipating possible shortages in 2024. Animal feed company leaders from Cambodia were visiting with animal feed application experts in Minnesota and North Dakota this week. The trade team built on a successful trade trip led by the American Soybean Association's World Innovation for Soy and Human Health, or WISH program, to Southeast Asia in 2023. Rusty Halverson talked with Alan Polk, director of the Asia Division of WISH, at the Northern Crops Institute on Wednesday, discussing what the trade delegation was learning about.
I'm Alan Polk. I'm the Asian Division Director with WISH, and it's a program of the American Soybean Association, and we're based in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay. We're visiting here at the Northern Crops Institute, and the reason we're visiting is because you've got a trade team from Cambodia that has come into the area with the help of the North Dakota Soybean Council. Can you tell us a little bit about that trade delegation from Cambodia? Where did you get started earlier this week?
We started out in Minneapolis. The team arrived Sunday evening, so we spent the first 2 days, Monday and Tuesday, meeting with U.S. exporters that handle containers, you know, primarily shipping to Asia. We also talked about the strong United States transportation infrastructure of shipping. So we visited a barge terminal, a transload facility at BNSF, and also a container loading facility to show the many different ways of how soy ends up in Asia.
Okay. And it is a long journey from here to Cambodia and Asia. What did you take away from what you saw, and what do you think the trade team took away from that visit to the Twin Cities area?
They really are impressed by the quality of U.S. soy, of how it's handled and shipped. You know, it travels, depending upon the route, it could take 40 days to get from, like, North Dakota to Asia, to Cambodia. So, you know, they're concerned about the quality and how's it maintained. But they really appreciated the grading system. You know, it's done by a third party. And also, earlier today here in Fargo, we had a retired North Dakota soybean farmer talk about quality and what he does to maintain the quality, and, you know, so that as it starts at the farm. And so that's something that's really resonated throughout the trip, of the high quality that is being produced in this part of the soybean growing area.
Okay. Well, speaking of our soybean growing area, the participants on the trade mission are visiting the feed mill here at NCI and learning about some of the characteristics of soybeans that are grown and processed here in North Dakota. Lots for them to learn about, especially the amino acid profile of our supplies in the north.
Right. So that was the heart of this trade team, is the value added of essential amino acids. You know, so many times the industry buys off a crude protein, which is nice, but animals use amino acids. That's what they grow. That's what they need to live and grow for their muscle fiber and everything in the meat. And so we're trying to share with them that here's how to calculate the essential amino acids, how to make it their better feed formulation. So they'll be hearing from feed formulation experts this week.
And when it comes to feeding of livestock in Cambodia, a very strong aquaculture industry. That's where these supplies will eventually end up.
Right. Cambodians love fish. It's an important part of their daily protein intake. And so there's concern over in Cambodia of the wild catch of, you know, environmental and sustainability. So the aquaculture industry has really taken off of farm-raised fish. Mm-hmm. And we've been working to introduce some new technologies there. But an important part of that is having high-quality aquaculture feed, which requires soybean meal. And so we've been talking about that, too, this week, of how to incorporate soybean meal into those feed rations to have a better quality product.
For their aquaculture industry, does the U.S. already have a presence in feeding that industry? Where have they got their supplies from traditionally?
So traditionally, the aquaculture feed came from Vietnam. There's a lot of trade between those two countries. But one of the feed mills here this week, they built Cambodia's first aquaculture feed mill. And that was really a big development in the industry there. His family saw the vision of aquaculture is going to grow. We feel we can make be a profitable move for us, an investment. And they're very proud of that investment of, you know, claiming to be, you know, Cambodia's first aquaculture feed mill, and we continue to work with them on technical assistance to improve their operations.
Okay, clarify for me, when we talk about them using soybean meal in the aquaculture industry, and you mentioned this feed mill, do you think the bulk of the soybeans that they want from the northern plains, do they want the raw product, or are they looking for processed soybean meal right up from the get-go?
Looking for the soybean meal. Okay. They don't have any crush capacity in Cambodia, so the meal part is very important for them. And that ties nicely into the big shift going on in North Dakota right now of instead of being exporting whole soybeans, you have all this extra soybean meal that you need to sell. And they're very excited of, hey, this is another opportunity, another source for soybean meal.
And when you talk about the shift that's going on in North Dakota, a lot of people are aware of the processing plant that is now operating near Jamestown, the Green Bison facility, and also the North Dakota Soy Processors facility coming online this year. And you mentioned the North Dakota Soybean Council. The council and the farmers are doing a lot of hard work on behalf of all farmers using checkoff funding to make sure that the soybean meal here finds a home, whether it be regionally, nationally, or overseas in this case.
Exactly. And so when we presented this proposal for their funding last year, they received it very positively, like, hey, this is, you're helping solve a problem that we have and how we can work together on this. And we're also using some USDA funding as well for this trade team to help, you know, bring over more people and to have a more robust course.
Okay. How many days overall will the trade team spend here? Is there anything else they'll be seeing on your trip that you're aware of?
So the team will be leaving this Saturday morning, go back home, but we'll be here for the next 2.5 days in North Dakota, meeting with companies, presentations. And one of the neat things is just learning more about feed rations and formulation of the essential amino acid. We've got some good speakers coming in. We're also going to do some software demonstrations on how to use those for feed formulation, the newest versions of it, to help them out.
It's another example of the soybean checkoff at work and the work you're doing around the world. We were talking about Cambodia now, but there are many countries in the world that WISH and ASA are working with for similar projects like this.
Yeah, so WISH has programs in Africa and Latin America, and we work in human foods, aquaculture, and animal feed. And an exciting program area of the world that WISH is expanding right now is Central Asia, which includes countries like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. We feel there's opportunities there. We're starting activities and building relationships there. And we feel that it's going to take some long-term work, some investment in time and resources, but they are very hungry to learn more about U.S. soybean meal and as they grow their livestock and livestock sector there.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. For today's featured interview, Susan Littlefield is talking with June Lowski, a veterinarian and also a cattle feeder from Columbus, Nebraska. She's part of the beef team with USMEF and currently in Japan. Here's the interview.
Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing. Right now you're in Japan. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing with USMEF.
Yeah, so USMEF has brought a group of cattle producers from the United States to Seoul, Korea, and Tokyo, Japan, to help promote beef in the USMEF market channels that they've already established. So we have spent time in the USMEF office. So USMEF stands for U.S. Meat Export Federation office in both Seoul and in Tokyo. They've taken us to the embassies in both countries, and we've been able to just see some of the successes and challenges of marketing beef in Asia.
So as you get the opportunity to absorb all of that, what has been some of your initial takeaways when you see the culture and see what they're wanting in beef?
There's been definitely a shift, both demographically and with what the consumer wants. So they've gone from a rice-based diet to a mainly meat-centric diet, and it's trending in that direction. And they've also, just like a lot of countries, the average age of the farmer has increased, and their ability to produce domestic protein is declining. And so there's great opportunity for increased market share because of that. Also, the declining birth rate has lent itself to a more of a one-person home where they have home meal replacements, restaurant meal replacements, much different than, but in the same line of like TV dinner type things where you take it and it's ready made, ready to go. Convenience is a huge driver for meal buying and meal planning. And so there's opportunity for beef in that area. Also, institutionally, we were at Samsung, for instance, which I think of more an electronic company, and they have a food service arm, which in one of their offices, they feed in cafeteria style over 8,000 meals a day. And in the country of Korea, they serve over 1 million meals a day, just as part of Samsung. And so seeing an opportunity in the institutional meal service or food service sector is huge. And USMEF is trying to capitalize on that market and come along Samsung with some beef products that are readily available, easy to prepare and use in institutions. So they feed not only cafeteria workers in their offices, but also provide meals for military, provide meals for hospitals, restaurants, golf courses, and wedding venues.
So you being a beef producer and being there firsthand, June, what type of questions are they bringing to you when they want to know about beef production in the United States?
So fun fact, I get to tomorrow show a video of our family and our feed yard and what we do in Nebraska, which in my mind represents hopefully all of the farmer feeders in eastern Nebraska. I'm just so proud to tell our story and who we are, even though we seem like maybe just a little drop in the bucket. Collectively, we are feeding them a nutritious, well-balanced, safe, high-quality end protein. But the questions that they have are, why aren't you producing more? Why is the supply down? When will that turn around? What are ways that we can ensure that foreign animal disease won't impede some of the market progress that we've made since BSE? They have concerns about avian influenza and what will that look like and what consumer perception will look like because of those kinds of challenges. They don't really ask a lot about sustainability, traceability, those kinds of things. But I know that being able to tell that part of the story as well just enhances their trust in U.S. produced beef.
We continue with the AgNet NewsHour. Now here's Susan Littlefield.
I think it's also unique too, June, that the arm of what USMEF does, because they're all over the world and they're kind of that advocating voice for you guys when you're working back hard in the States.
Yeah, I was just talking to John Hinners about the quality of the staff that they have both in Korea and in Japan. And they are out beating the bushes, finding new marketing channels and maintaining relationships with those that they already have. The people in Korea, they were very quick to tell us about just the family bonds that they have with some of the people who they directly market beef with. A new opportunity that they have just found in the past couple years is a company called The Meat Box, where they have taken out a lot of the middleman and take boxes of beef straight from regional and major packers and deliver it to end users. And when that's done, within 3 to 4 months of time, it can happen on a chilled, never frozen product because of the way that it's packaged. And I'm just so amazed at the quality of staff that USMEF has in place, both in Japan and in Korea, to find those markets, to maintain those relationships, and to really work hard for us as cattle producers in the United States to have a spot for our amazing product to be used.
So how do you plan, June, then, as you gather all this information, you have the opportunity to speak to so many people, how do you plan to kind of share that information with other beef producers and just those in general in agriculture when you return?
There is so much to learn. Just it's easy for me to get in my, these are the tasks that I have at hand for the day and they need to get done. And I get it without super people at home continuing to keep the feed truck rolling and all of the things that they do every day. There's not a lot of opportunity or extra time to educate the producers that were around every day, but I so desire to continue to remind them that there's people that are really overlooking and in our best interest, having regulatory measures in place that we can get beef from the packers, from the feed yards to the packers, to our end users, and just the multiple steps that go into making that happen. It's just thinking about something that I learned with tolerance levels just over the past couple days being in the U.S. embassies, both in Korea and in Japan. Our minimum tolerance levels for different feed additives and antibiotics in the United States may not be the same as it is in foreign countries. And for example, even though like ractopamine and other feed additives might have one tolerance level in a muscle cut, they have different tolerance levels in intestines that are also utilized in food service products. So if you're choosing to feed ractopamine or lubabagron and use antibiotics, making sure you understand what withdrawal levels are, suggested time periods for feeding are. Those are extremely important in international markets.
Well, it's been great to talk to you, and it sounds like an absolutely amazing event that's going on right now. Is there anything else that you would like to add before we wrap everything up?
We get to participate in a live food show, which was a kind of an experience. And in that hour, $27,000 of beef were sold online during that time. And I guess it was double what some of the normal food shows were. And sometimes I think we get in our little operations and we think our part is minuscule, but collaboratively, we are feeding the world. Like I said before, with a high quality, safe, nutrient dense protein. And I just think about, it reminds me of a little guy who long ago he gave his lunch to feed a multitude. And I just think each of us as cattle producers in the United States collectively feed the world. And I'm just so proud of who we are and what we do and what I get to represent here.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.